You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we talk about sustainability in water, food, and agriculture in general. We'll talk with award-winning writer Mary Swander, who has an agricultural podcast. And we talk with an activist who works with the local population in Central America to help them fight for clean water. And we talk with an author who went to work in a slaughterhouse in England to gain an understanding of what it means to come face to face with the food chain and the animals that die for it. We also talk with the inventors of a new app that helps sustain family recipes for future generations. But first, we stay close to home and talk about the potential threat posed by agricultural runoff in Iowa's rivers, lakes, and streams, and how those contaminants can possibly make you sick if you ingest water while you're out kayaking or swimming or doing any other recreational sport on the water. David Swartney is the director of the University of Iowa's Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination. He says there is a difference in how we look at contaminants in drinking water and the water we use for recreational purposes.
The things we worry about, you know, in terms of recreational contact with water and public health, it's a little bit different from what you worry about with respect to, say, drinking water, right? So anything that you're intentionally ingesting, we worry about a lot more from a standpoint of drinking water. But for recreational, you worry about bacteria and other pathogens, so disease-causing organisms that might get into the water supply from any number of sources. We know we have runoff issues in a lot of our surface waters around the state where there could be, say, bacteria and other pathogens from manure that might run off. We know we have older infrastructure like sewer systems that might get overwhelmed during a rainfall event and lead to some discharge of untreated waste. So you worry about those. You worry about the ingestion of these disease-causing organisms, and then that can lead to a variety of things that are just acute illnesses. And what I mean by acute is, you know, you worry about the effect, the unwanted health effect happening immediately. So it's not like, a lot of things we worry about with drinking water, we worry about making us sick over a lifetime of drinking water that's contaminated. For recreational contact, you worry about things that you might incidentally ingest, and then, you know, the next day or so, you'll start to feel those symptoms of having something that you shouldn't have ingested in your body. So the big ones are those bacteria, those viruses, those other pathogens that you worry about that might be there if the water is of lower quality.
What about if you've got, you know, cuts or scrapes? I know my daughter came back with camp with cuts and scrapes and was in the water all the time.
Yeah, and so that's you have to think about how you're coming into contact with any contaminated water, right? And so there's, when we think about recreating on water, if you're a skilled kayaker and you're on top of the water, well, that might be a different lower level risk event, right? Because you're skilled, you're unlikely to come into contact. If you're swimming, if you're wading, we worry about maybe little children that have cuts or might have weaker immune systems than maybe a fully fledged adult. Then you do have to worry about potentially, you know, being exposed through that contact. And if you have cuts and scrapes, those sorts of places that might be easier for a bacteria or something to infect, you know, you could be more prone to having an unwanted outcome like a rash or a skin infection that results from coming into contact with contaminated water.
Mm. What is the danger from antibiotic resistant bacteria in the waters?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think we're still, you know, trying to get our head around, you know, what the real human health risks are with antibiotic resistant pathogens that we might come in contact with in the environment. But the concern, I think most of us have probably heard about antibiotic resistant infections in, say, a healthcare setting, where we know that there are these, you know, people call them superbugs that are less prone, non-responsive to traditional antibiotic treatments, because at some point in that bacteria's life cycle, it's developed a tolerance to being exposed to the antibiotic. And so instead of dying, it actually can still live. That's concerning, because if you come into contact with a bacteria that might be resistant to a certain type of antibiotic and you get that infection, it's going to be harder to treat. It could be more persistent. You might have to use different types of antibiotics, ones that we talk about as being, stronger or quote unquote last resort, to try to make sure the infection is responsive to an antibiotic treatment. So it's a bit of an emerging risk that we're trying to get our heads on when it comes to environmental exposures. We know, you know, that if we have bacteria in our water, and some of that could come from agriculture, and we know we heavily use antibiotics in agriculture for some swine production, there's some growing concern that we potentially have these types of antibiotic-resistant microbes in the environment, and it could be a source by which these infections spread.
Well, I was reading a article in the Des Moines Register about how some people are afraid to go, you know, in some rivers and streams, and others really don't, you know, care or really understand it. Do you think it's pretty safe to go kayaking?
You know, I think everybody's looking for, with regards to recreating in Iowa's waters, everyone's looking for a straight, like, yes or no answer. Is it safe or isn't it? And I don't think it's that simple. So there's levels of risk, right? And we know that as water gets more contaminated with things like bacteria, the risk that recreating in water could lead to an illness increases. But what's safe for one person may not be safe for another. So we all have varying immune systems that respond in different ways. And so, you know, I don't think there's going to be a simple yes or no for everybody. I think what we should be trying to do is be as upfront about our water quality challenges here in Iowa. We should make as much information through monitoring available to people that are interested in recreating. Let them know the risks that are associated, because there's a lot of science out there that tries to help better understand if we measure this, that means your risk is this. You know, make that information available so people can make their own choices, right? Because there will be people that understand those risks and see the rewards from recreating is far greater than those risks in their mind, and they'll do it. They'll want to recreate. There might be others with young children or with family members that are immunocompromised that think, well, maybe this isn't the right thing for me and my family. So I think the best we can do is be upfront about our water quality challenges. We should give the information through robust monitoring to Iowans and then let them make up their mind what they're comfortable with. I think it's just important that we emphasize that we do have fairly unique water quality challenges here in the state, right? I think people should acknowledge, you know, we have to be upfront that our waters are impaired, even by things like the Clean Water Act and how we federally regulate our waters. That if we want to be able to get the full benefit for recreating on waters, we should want to be more serious about maintaining their quality, which means being a little more serious with how we control the pollutants that end up in our water supply. You know, if you want to recreate on waters with low risk, then we should be doing things to make sure that we aren't letting things like manure and other type of runoff get into our water and impair it in the first place. So we talk a lot about source water protection with respect to our drinking water resources. If we want the quality of life benefits and the economic benefits that come with bringing people to the water, then we should be getting really serious about making sure we protect the quality of our resources so that everybody can enjoy them, right? I think I was quoted in one piece talking about the skilled kayakers are going to come. They're going to want to recreate. They will find the way. What we should be trying to do in Iowa is make the water a place where everybody can recreate, where you're bringing in people of all skill levels and all experiences that they're trying to have with water. And I worry that our water quality and people knowing that it's poor in some places, it's going to deter folks from wanting to take full advantage of our resources. And that's a shame.
That was David Swertney, the director of the University of Iowa Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination. He talked about what we need to keep in mind as we go swimming or kayaking in Iowa's lakes, rivers, and streams in terms of contaminants and the bacteria that can cause illness. A lot of people have stood their ground against environmental threats in the water in the last 5 years. In the book, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed, authors and husband and wife John Kavanaugh and Robin Broad tell the David and Goliath story of a coalition of local residents and international allies that succeeded in ousting the Pacific Rim Mining Company from El Salvador and ending the pollution of its water there. I talked to Kavanaugh about the process.
But in El Salvador, it started about 15 years ago, and they were about 5 years into their work when we discovered them. And we discovered them because my institute gave a human rights award to them. We really didn't know much about them. It was others who had nominated them. And then they came to Washington and told us about their fight and told us that the fight was playing out here in our court in Washington, not down there, and they asked for our help. So we created this group called International Allies that brought all these forces together to support them. But they were already about 5 years into their fight by that point. And these two entities then interacted beautifully in fighting back against these very powerful mining companies.
In the book, you talk about the violence that can be involved in this, and one man in particular who was supposed to come to Washington, D.C. and never made it there.
Yes. So once my institute, the Institute for Policy Studies, decided to give this award to the Water Defenders of El Salvador, they put together a delegation of five people to come. We would give them the award, and then they would tour cities in the U.S. and Canada to tell their stories. And so we just had started to plan in the summer of 2009 for their trip when we learned that one of the five had been assassinated right in the middle of mining country. He was a leader of the opposition. Wasn't clear who killed him. They suspected the mining company or the mayor in the town, who the mining company had a very close relationship to. And for us, what a shock. Imagine, I mean, here in the United States, we're watching people protest around climate issues, around the pipelines in the Midwest and so on. But rarely do you hear of someone being killed. And so here we were, one of the people, key people, had been killed. We invited them. We said to them, please bring someone else. They picked his brother. And it was his brother who we became very close to over the ensuing 7 to 8 years. It was his brother who asked us specifically, can you in the United States help us understand this tribunal where this mining company is suing our government? Please help, because you have access to this institution and we don't. And so that's how we got wrapped in. We weren't expecting to get involved in this fight. I've been involved with giving these human rights awards for several decades, but this one was special in part because Marcelo Rivera, that's the name of the man who was killed, was assassinated, and then the people around him asked for our help.
There has been a mining ban, right, since 2017.
So that's amazing. I mean, I think the thing for your listeners to understand, Mary, is that mining is, of course, essential. Look around your room. Half of the things you're looking at have metals in them. So mining is essential, and yet it is incredibly dangerous, both to workers. It's in many ways, it's always in the list of top 10 most dangerous professions to work in, but it's devastating on the environment because to mine, you have to extract rock, you have to pulverize it, you have to use cyanide to separate the precious minerals like gold from the rock. The cyanide can pollute rivers. It's incredibly dangerous. And the people of El Salvador, as they learned about this, and they visited across the river, they have a big river separating them from Honduras. As they visited mines in Honduras, they saw the toxic remains. They saw dead rivers, dead fish, skin diseases, and they decided they had to fight it. So we got involved and helped with the lawsuit, but they led a fight to convince their government to become the first government in the world to ban all mining to save their rivers. And it's remarkable. I just want to say, talk about inspiring. If they can do this in one of the poorest nations on earth, with a government that is heavily dependent on foreign corporations, imagine what we can do here in the United States in our own fights, not just to protect water, but to protect other things that are dear to people. So our hats are off to these water defenders in El Salvador for pressing their government to stand up and be a first. And I must say, part of what's inspiring is other governments are watching them, and other governments, under pressure from their own publics, have started to take action too.
And a lot of people argue globalization has given so much power to these transnational global corporations to do basically whatever they want that undermines the sovereignty of these countries. Do you think that globalization, number one, was obviously a major factor, but do you think it just continues to become an issue, especially when we talk about taking advantage of, I don't know if we still call them developing countries, but countries that just don't have a lot of power on the global scale?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge, huge issue. one that I think most people in this country became far more aware of in the pandemic, when all of a sudden they couldn't buy certain products, because it turns out an awful lot of what we purchase in our lives today, from food to clothing to computers to phones, are produced with products from other countries, are invariably assembled in other countries. A huge amount of what we buy is assembled or produced in China and comes all the way around the world. And when those supply chains were interrupted by COVID, we saw some of the dangers of becoming that dependent. But your larger point, yes, really starting in the 1970s and 1980s, as corporations got bigger and had the ability to move their operations across borders, they got too much power. Before that, there was a bit of a dance between workers and communities who would demand certain things of companies and the companies who depended on those markets. Once those corporations went global, and as I said, most of the products we eat and consume are now global, those companies got too much power. And yes, they relocated production to a lot of poorer countries where they could pay lower wages, where they could skirt environmental regulations. That is part of the history of El Salvador, but of many countries in Latin America and Africa and Asia. And hence, a lot of the fights, interesting fights, for basic rights for the environment that we see in the world today result from that. They are communities saying, you are exploiting us, you are exploiting our natural resources, our rivers, our labor, and we won't put up with it. And this is a great example of a fight where the communities and the environment won.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm talking with David Swertney. He and his wife, Robin Broad, are the authors of the new book, The Water Defenders: How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed.
Here in the U.S., I've talked to a lot of people about the need for clean water and the high cost of clean water. What do you think can be done, or what is being done, to try and alleviate that situation?
Here we are, Mary, we're sitting in the richest country on earth. We have abundant water supplies. So we're not like El Salvador that has very little water, fresh water per capita, or many African countries. We have plenty of water, and yet we have close to 20 million people who do not have access to clean and affordable water in the richest nation on earth. So that's a moral abomination. And I will say, I do a lot of work with a movement called the Poor People's Campaign. They surveyed poor and low-income people all across the country, and they said, what are your biggest concerns? And among the top five invariably were this issue, that they did not have access to clean and affordable water and or sanitation. So people are fighting back on this. I think the country got a wake-up call last winter when it turned out that when the pipes that bring water into the homes of Texas and Mississippi in particular froze, and a lot of the pipes cracked, I think people understood, oh my God, we've got a problem here. We have an old aging infrastructure, and not enough money has been put into actually fulfilling this basic right of human beings to have clean and affordable water. And so people are fighting for it all over. They're fighting for it when they fight against big mines like the Apache in Arizona or the big pipeline going across northern Minnesota. They're fighting to protect their water from mines and pipelines.
And John, you point out that Flint, Michigan is a great example of people who really fought against bad water with lead in their water.
The place that everyone knows about, of course, that got a huge amount of attention was Flint, Michigan, where they shifted their water to a river that was full of pollutants, which then eroded these old lead pipes that people had in their homes, and people were being poisoned. So it's a giant priority to shift this. And I just want to say one more thing on this that's hopeful. People in Congress have heard enough about this problem that in these infrastructure bills that Congress is considering right now and will vote on early in the fall, there's over $100 billion for water infrastructure to actually rebuild the pipes, the aging, decrepit pipes, many of them 50, 60, 70 years old, many of them still made out of lead. and replace them that in a way that would at least provide clean water. We still have to work on the affordable water.
Around the Midwest, especially Iowa, we have a lot of problems with runoff from hog and cattle operations. The waste gets into the water and contaminates it. We've got herbicides, pesticides, and we try and fight it with various tactics, but it seems like it's still a big issue.
We've talked about mining. We've talked about oil pipelines. We've talked about decaying pipes. You've just raised another huge one. So the U.S. has a giant agribusiness sector in this country. Right where I live in Maryland, so right here, a lot of it is giant corn farms and chicken farms, all of them dumping pollutants. And as you say, a lot of it is fertilizer, pesticides. In chicken farms, it's also the excrement from the chickens, and it's going into our waterways, and it's polluting them. I'm finding that around the country, in the areas where it gets bad, and so people have died in Maryland from this, that's when people react. It's interesting, in our area, of course, rivers don't follow state lines, so a lot of our river systems in the United States go through many states. In our area, it's the Chesapeake Bay that is being polluted by all of this. So activists in Virginia, Maryland, Washington, D.C., as far up as Pennsylvania, have come together and put pressure on governments to set aside a huge amount of money to shift the farms and areas around these fragile water ecosystems in a more sustainable way. And the bay is starting to get cleaner. So the same thing, of course, same fights around the Great Lakes. And there you have not just different states, you have different countries because it's the U.S. and Canada. So just as in the story of El Salvador, when people are really affected, and in the case of El Salvador, four people were killed. In the United States, people are being killed by agrochemicals. And when it becomes enough of an issue, people organize and they fight back. So I find governments don't tend to do things just on their own. They do it when people demand it. And I think water will be one of the top five issues in this country over the next decade, particularly as climate change dries up certain areas. And it will be communities demanding much more responsible behavior and regulation by government that will bring the wins that we need.
That was John Kavanaugh. He and his wife, Robin Broad, are the authors of the book, The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. John is also the director of the Washington-based Institute for Policy Studies, an organization that collaborates with the Poor People's Campaign and other dynamic social movements.